Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Almonds, pistachios, mandarins, pomegranates, grapes, olives, cotton, California can seemingly grow it all. The land is fertile, and the water, well, the water. For 150 years, water has been the source of great conflict and greed in an effort to make California the promised land. We've pumped, diverted, piped, and channeled water every which way in the Golden State, from places where it is to places where it isn't. But my guest today, California native and author Mark Ericks, says this way of life is no longer tenable. And in his new book, he takes us across history and land to tell us the story of California's water. So this hour on Point, the dreamt land. And you can join us. Is the story of California's water wars something you've lived with? What is your take on agriculture in California and the way things are now? And what lessons do California's struggles with water hold for the rest of us as climate change makes all of us think, no matter where we live in the United States, about this most precious of resources? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining us today from Fresno, California, is Mark Ericks. He is a longtime writer and journalist and author. He formerly wrote for the Los Angeles Times, where he covered California's Central Valley. And he's author of several books. His most recent, out today, is called The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. Mark, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me, Meghna.
It's really great to have you. So, you know, first of all, I guess for folks who might not be terribly familiar with sort of California's aquatic landscape, if I could put it that way, can you just paint a picture for us? What does the water landscape from north to south look like in California?
Well, first you have to begin with this idea that we took the edge of a continent 1,000 miles long, and we declared it one place, one state. The problem is that nature has about 8 different states within those 1,000 miles, and the fathers of California, at least the fathers after they wiped out our natives, decided that they were going to create, you know, equality among these places. And so how do you do that when in one spot in the north it rains 150 inches a year, and another spot in the south, the Mojave Desert, it rains 4 or 5 inches a year? And what they decided to do was build the grandest hydraulic reclamation project the world had ever seen. And it's really two projects, the Central Valley Project, which was built in the 1930s, and the State Water Project, which came about 20 to 25 years later. And we have this delta that's, you know, outside of San Francisco, where all the waters of 3 or 4 rivers pool. And that delta ends up, if you look at it almost like a body, that's the heart of California. And then you have all these arteries connecting that heart to various parts of the body. And some of those arteries are ditches and canals, some are dams, and some are this grand aqueduct that literally moves the rain from north to south 700 miles. And you know, it's just the nth degree of manipulation, and it's a magnificent system. But during this last drought, it got tested in a way that had never been tested before.
I mean, it's fair to say that the California we know today is unimaginable without the hubris and ambition of humankind in the middle of the last century.
That's right. I mean, there were like 2 inventions of California. One as a myth, and then one as a real place. And that second invention is, you know, pretty messy. You're talking about altering the landscape in a way that had never been altered before. And I'm talking to you from Fresno, which is used to be known as the raisin capital of the world, and now it's a land of a lot of nuts, almonds and pistachios, and so you see these takings that happened, and to understand what was going on in the land today, I had to trace it back to the roots. You're really tracing a culture of extraction, mm-hmm. is what you're doing.
Mm. Well, since you mentioned that you're in Fresno there, I was wondering if you might read a little bit from the prologue of your new book, The Dreamt Land, where you describe the landscape around you as you drive down Highway 99. Could you read that for us, Mark?
Sure. Every river busting out of the Sierra was bent sideways, if not backward, by a bulwark of ditches, levees, canals, and dams. The farmer corralled the snowmelt and erased the valley, its desert and marsh. He leveled its hog wallows, denuded its salt brush, and killed the last of its mustang, antelope, and tule elk. He emptied the sky of tens of millions of geese and drained the 800 square miles of Tulare Lake dry. He did this first in the name of wheat, then beef, milk, raisins, cotton, and nuts. Once he finished grabbing the flow of the five rivers that ran across the plain, he used his turbine pumps to seize the water beneath the ground. As he bled the aquifer dry, he called on the government to bring him an even mightier river from afar. Down the great aqueduct, by freight of politics and gravity, came the excess waters of the Sacramento River. The farmer commanded the distant flow. The more water he took, the more crops he planted, and the more crops he planted, the more water he needed to plant more crops. And on and on.
That's Mark Erecks, author of The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California, reading from an early section of his book. You know, Mark, in hearing your description of the Central Valley there, I wonder, what makes California's relationship with water different than much of the rest of the southwestern United States? Because you could look at a 60,000 foot level and say this story of water extraction, of water movement, is the story of the West, actually, or at least the Southwest and parts of the West Coast writ large. Is it not? So what makes California different?
That's a great question. So, you know, we call much of the state a desert, but just on the other side of the valley are these great Sierra Nevada mountains, and they're one of the most fantastic watersheds, on Earth. And so technically you're on land where it's not raining, and it's technically desert, and yet just 100 miles away are these mountains that are just soaked with water and snow. So it's this enticement. I mean, geez, it's right there. Let's take it. And that taking begins in the gold rush. I mean, the mining of gold is really the mining of water first. They took the rivers coming out of the Sierra, and back then the early gold miners were operating in those rivers, and then the industrialists came in and took over gold mining, and they built this system of flumes and dams that moved that snow melt to where the gold was. And then they created this hydraulic system where they took the water out of the flumes and they forced it through a canvas hose. And at the end of the hose was a nozzle. And that nozzle became hydraulic, the hydraulic water system. The gold rush ended up polluting the rivers. And and all that silt came down the mountain and started covering up the farmland. And so California had a decision in the late 1800s. Do we keep mining gold, or is the next gold down the mountain in the valley where we grow the crops? And so the system moved from the mountain and gold mining down the mountain to the valley. And this is where we see the next extraction. And that extraction, the men of gold ended up becoming wheat farmers. They were living in Nob Hill, the fanciest section of San Francisco, and yet they were growing wheat in the Central Valley. And these characters, Isaac Friedlander, 6'7", they said his strides were twice the strides of a normal man. He became the wheat king of the United States, you know, operating out of Nob Hill, but then having this distant farmland.
Wow. And so...
So it was those Sierras that made us different from the rest of the Southwest.
Interesting. And we'll talk more about sort of how that hunger, that thirst, I should say, for California's thirst for water has grown far beyond the Sierras here. But tell us a bit more about some of the other early figures that you write about in the book. Henry Miller, who was he?
Henry Miller left Germany when he was 13, 14 years old, moved to New York, became a butcher. An expert at, you know, slaughtering hogs and things like that. And then he makes his way. He comes like the rest of them for the gold rush. And he decides that, you know, he's not going to become a miner. He's not going to go on a donkey and go into the hills of California. He is going to move to San Francisco and serve the miners, and he's going to do it as a butcher. And he becomes the second largest butcher in San Francisco. And he joins up with the first largest butcher, and they decide, well, let's vertically integrate this operation. Let's grow the cows. And so where do you grow them at? He comes to the San Joaquin Valley, and he ends up buying not only land, but land along rivers, the San Joaquin River and the Kern River. And he ends up owning, if you can own such a thing, because water is a public resource, mm-hmm. technically, but he ends up owning both sides of these rivers and controlling the flow of farmland and controlling the flow of the water and also the farmland. And he ends up, the story about Henry Miller is that he could ride his horse from the border of Mexico to the border of Canada and never spend a single night on land that wasn't his.
Oh, wow. Well, we are talking this hour with Mark Erics. He is author of the new book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. We're talking about California's water wars and what lessons the Golden State has for the rest of us in intelligent management of a resource we cannot live without. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Mark Erics. He is author of the new book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. And we're talking about the story of California's relationship with water, its manipulation of water, its extraction, its first extraction, as Mark Erics calls it, and the lesson it holds for the rest of us as climate change makes water an ever more essential resource that needs intelligent management, send us a comment through Twitter or Facebook at On Point Radio. And Mark, before we dive back into some of the details and the terrific stories you have in your book, I just want to, in the interest of full disclosure, I want to tell you that even though I'm here in Boston, I am a native Oregonian, grew up in the Pacific Northwest. So California's thirst for water is something that I knew a lot about growing up, because every once in a while they'd pop up the idea of building a pipeline from the mouth of the Columbia River between Oregon and Washington all the way down to California, and we Oregonians would kind of resent it, you know. So this is like it's a regional issue.
No, some of the ideas, I mean, you know, to taking building a pipeline from Alaska, I mean, all to satisfy this desire of California to keep growing. I mean, and you know, there's great resentment. I always get a rental car when I go to Oregon with the Oregon license plates, because I don't want to be driving in with my California license plates.
Probably a wise thing to do.
Yeah.
But also, you know, we should talk more about where much of this water is being used, because you're reading to us about the farmers of the Central Valley today. And anyone who's crossed the Oregon-California border, or any border into California, knows that agriculture is so vitally important here that they still search the trunk of your car for bringing out-of-state fruit into California in case, you know, you're going to accidentally bring an invasive species or something in there. So how important is the agriculture, which sucks up, what, 30% of California's water? How important is agriculture for the state and for the nation today?
You know, folks that look at California from afar, I mean, they see Hollywood, they see Silicon Valley. What they do is they jump over the great middle of California. This great middle is really, it's called the Central Valley, but the Central Valley is two valleys. It's the Sacramento Valley and the San Joaquin Valley, each shaped by a river, what was a magnificent river, the San Joaquin. If you drive along Highway 99 today and you cross over the San Joaquin River, it's dry. It's dry because it's being diverted by ditch and canal to all this farmland. And there's 6 million acres of farmland in the San Joaquin Valley alone. So it's incredible, and yet it's not understood. And the developed water, the water that we capture off the snowmelt, much of it obviously ends up evaporating. Some of it goes into the forests. A good deal goes out to the ocean. But the captured water, 80% of that is used by agriculture. And, you know, it takes water to grow crops. Mm. The city that used to be the farm, Los Angeles, San Francisco, they don't understand that taking. And so baked into California are these water wars. And they get quite ugly during drought times. Not so ugly during flood times. We're in a flood mode right now. And so the agriculture is, it's like no agriculture anywhere. Given our combination of soil and sun and those sierras as our water source, we can grow just about anything here in a Mediterranean climate. And that 230 crops. And, you know, we like to say that we feed, that a third of America's food comes from the valley. That's a little misleading, because we're growing a lot of specialty crops that sell for a lot, you know, almonds, nuts, grapes, table grapes, wine grapes, tomatoes, yeah, cantaloupes, you know, all that. So it is, you know, you drive literally the mountains that separate the Los Angeles' sprawl from the sprawl of farmland. They're like our Mason-Dixon line. Mm. And you cross over and you've entered a different place. It's different culturally. It's different politically. It's a conservative place. And here in Fresno, we're in the middle of, you know, a valley that almost has been exiled both geographically and psychically from the rest of California.
Yeah. So that's really compelling, because on the other hand, though, if you look at the numbers around water consumption, right? I mean, we're talking about the centrality of water here to the story of California. I mean, check me on some of these numbers. I'm seeing here that just one crop, just those almonds, which everyone loves, but just the almond crop in California consumes 10% of all the developed water in California. One crop, is that right?
Yeah, and what you see is we have these booms and busts of agriculture, just like we have these. It's a system we've developed here of boom and bust, and so now the boom crop are nuts. And so I was driving along the length of California recently during spring, and the almonds bloom white. And I'm telling you, the entire drive I was followed by white. So there are now 1.5 million acres of almonds alone and another 300,000 acres of pistachios. It's the hot new crop. You know, we're selling it to China, at least until, you know, the Trump trade wars end up affecting nuts. And so you're when you look at the almond, I mean, the almond became demonized almost during the drought.
Yeah.
You know, every almond took a gallon of water. That is true. But when you start doing that breakdown, when it comes even like lentils, well, lentils take a great deal of water. Nothing takes more water than the cow, you know. So that's what this, you know, the city folks were trying to, you know, you're making us cut our showers. You're making us dry our green lawns so we can give water to the almond. And that's how it got reduced. It got simplified and the water wars raged.
Well, I definitely want to hear from you more about sort of the stories of individuals, especially in these agricultural communities in California that you chronicle so well in the book. But one more question about why, yeah, so the water wars did get somewhat reduced down to numbers and regions. But don't those California city folk have a point? Because I'm seeing here some other numbers that even though agriculture is so big in California, as a percentage of the state's overall, you know, $2.5 trillion economy, agriculture just generates a couple of percent of that. So, you know, but it consumes three times as much water as anybody else.
So this is where we get into the weeds a tad bit. I'll try to simplify it. So when you look at Los Angeles, Los Angeles had a small river, the LA River. They had tapped into it by the late 1800s. So they went out and stole themselves, you know, three different rivers. First, it was the Owens River from the Owens Valley. They dried out that valley 200 miles away. Then they went to the Colorado River. And then they went to the Sacramento River. Way up in the, okay. So LA, the farmer here is going to tell you, what does LA have a right to preach to us anything? They're growing suburbia across the desert with borrowed water.
Yeah.
In the valley, we have these five rivers here. And those are the rivers that chiefly are being tapped into for agriculture. So there's a proprietary sense, okay, well, we're growing food, we're growing these crops, and we're using our own rivers. Even if we had to borrow another valley river, the Sacramento, to help us out. So it's just not so simple. And then the folks up north, you know, up Mount Shasta down to Sacramento, they feel put upon because it's their rivers, their system that is being borrowed by all the rest of the state. So it's a weird kind of, you know, logic.
Yeah. Well, so everyone's feeling put upon because California's at 40 million people built on a water infrastructure, as you're talking about, which, I mean, as you said, the drought revealed that it's a finite resource and California's future is to face more such, you know, such challenges. So it makes sense that people are sort of looking at each other as, well, you're the problem. No, you're the problem. But you're saying the whole system is the problem.
Yeah, the system was magnificent, but it was built when we had 11 million people here. We've got 40 million now, as you say. So the system is cracking under these demands and something has to give. And the problem in California, you know, the impression that everybody has of California is a very progressive state. It tackles these environmental issues before any other states. And that tackling then becomes a model for other states. But it took us 165 years to regulate the taking of groundwater, that great aquifer beneath us. And so we were taking it so much that the land was sinking, not inches, but feet, you know, 30, 40 feet. Sinking, and the land was sinking, and then the roads and the canals were sinking along with it. So there's this kind of madness to the extraction, And that's what we're now confronting. And California, as progressive as it is, doesn't want to start off with a number, the number being how big can we get?
Right.
Can we be 50 million, 60 million? If so, where's the water going to come from? And we have this great volatility of climate. Our whole history is one of swinging from drought to flood. And yet we forget about drought as soon as we're in flood, and we forget about flood as soon as we're in drought. But that is now teaming up with climate change, and so we're going to get these havocs that we've never had before.
Yeah. I mean, doesn't it just makes you mourn a fundamental truth about human nature, that as soon as we're back in the good times, we forget how bad the bad times were. I mean, that drought that California only just barely came out of was a decade long. I was just out there in the Bay Area last month, and everything was green and blooming, and people seemed to think, you know, they were... I'm not criticizing them, but some of them were behaving as if they just hadn't lived through 10 straight years of a virtual water emergency.
No, there's this kind of collective amnesia that is remarkable to see. It really is. And we've grown in places that we shouldn't have grown. I mean, I was up in Paradise, the
right,
city,
right?
The city on a built on a kind of ridge, a chimney that was nearly burned off the map.
Yeah. Destroyed, by the wildfires.
And I'm writing a piece about that now, a magazine piece. And it was stunning to think. When I went up there, I thought, well, it was a little mountain village, you know, like there are across the Sierras. But they had taken basically the idea of a strip mall from Los Angeles and the suburban model of L.A., the sprawl, and they had plopped it up there in the path of wildfire. And it came. And yet... there was no agency of the state, not even Cal Fire, that told them, listen, you can't grow a city up here. It's doomed. It's destined to burn. And that's what happened. And yet in the midst of that all, you know, folks are deciding to build again right there.
Well, you know, we've got some callers who want to share their stories with us. So, Mark, stand by here for just a moment. We are talking with Mark Erics. His new book is The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. Let's go to Tim, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Tim, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? First, I'd like to compliment the author on what a wonderful excerpt and what a PhD-level class you're giving people in water issues around the Southwest and the West in general. I've worked in and around the water industry out there for a number of years and lived in Los Angeles. And it's just so nice to hear these topics being brought up. I went back to Los Angeles at the tail end of the drought. It was unlike anything I'd ever seen before in terms of the change from what it was when I lived there. And essentially what we're looking at is the underpricing of a public good. And we've created this mess around us through the waste, the green lawns, the fountains in Vegas, the agricultural that you've done such a nice job highlighting the problems there. And I'm just going to take the rest of it off the air. But I really do appreciate hearing these issues on the radio there at NPR.
Tim, thank you so much for your call. Mark, I mean, Tim brings up a point that has water been underpriced? And eventually will we have to pay the piper, for lack of a better term?
Well, you're seeing that right now. There's a water market, and farmers in the Sacramento Valley, rice farmers who are growing a crop that doesn't have a great profit margin, but they have plenty of water up there. They're now partnering up with farmers in the middle of California, and they're saying, you know, we're selling our water. So water that was, you know, sold for $200 an acre foot. An acre foot is a weird way of measuring water. I wish I could instantly put it into gallons, but it would be a very large number. They're selling that water for $600 now an acre foot. And that water market is interesting because it frees up water. It also is scary in that what'll happen in times of scarcity is only the biggest cities, the biggest farmers will be able to afford that water. And so water then becomes a means by which to make California a more unequal place. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that is it's a good solution. But it all, it's also fraught with some issues.
Yeah, and a little later, I want to talk to you about a very large farmer, maybe the richest farmer in America, who at one time was farming water as well. But let's quickly go to another caller here. Let's go to Suzanne, who's calling from West Hampton, New York. Suzanne, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I want to talk a little bit about landscaping and lawns. Food is one thing. We all need food. But what we don't need is green lawn, which also, incidentally, have a lot to do with water pollution, fertilizer, pesticides. But here on the East Coast, we use 70% of our water in the summertime on landscaping, and we're landscaping and watering with plants that don't belong here. Any ecosystem, wherever it is, has within it the plants that can withstand the environment, all the wind, the sun, the temperatures, the water, and yet we're bringing plants from all over the world to plant in places where they don't belong, and then we use water. And the biggest culprit is the lawns. I know that the Sea of Cortez is dried up before it gets to the coast because of water that's being taken out upstream. Yeah. And a lot of it's for landscaping. And again, we all need food, but do we really need the landscaping?
Right.
I call it the ecosystem versus the ecosystem.
Well, Suzanne, I'm going to take it back from there because we have to take a break. But thank you so much for your call. A caller, Suzanne from New York, there saying that humans build an ecosystem rather than an ecosystem around them. We're talking this hour with Mark Erics, his author of the new book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Mark Erics. He is author of the new book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. And there's an excerpt, by the way, of Mark's book at our website, onpointradio.org. Mark, a little early in the show, you talked about how water in California and its story isn't actually all that well understood, even by many Californians. I'm wondering if you yourself didn't understand it as a boy growing up in Fresno. I mean, what was your awareness of the water and its complicated politics and history?
My grandparents lived in a suburb of Fresno right next to a big irrigation canal. And there were these ditches that just crisscrossed, almost like lattice work, our suburban neighborhoods. And you're growing up in this thing, and you're really stupid to your place, you know, as a kid, as all kids probably are. I certainly was. And I never asked myself, you know, where's this water coming from? Who's it going to, and by what right? And all I knew is my grandmother would tell me, don't go near that irrigation canal. Don't walk up there. You'll get dizzy. You'll fall in. You'll drown, and they won't recover your body. And I said, well, why not? She said, because that water needs to flow to these farms, and they're not going to shut down that flow to recover the body of one silly boy. And so, you know, so we were kind of dumb to our place, and that puzzle is what really kind of keeps me at this place, trying to figure it out. And it's a life's work; it really is to understand what we did here. The reinventions upon the original invention, and so it's kind of a privilege to be able to figure out your place.
Right. Well, you know, so in your book though, you tell the story about how your own family was felt or lived the California dream that water helped make possible, right? Because you share a bit from a letter that your grandfather received from his uncle who in Fresno.
Yeah.
Yeah, during the late 19-teens. I was wondering if you could just share a little bit of, or tell us about that letter and share a little bit of what was written.
Yeah, I'll set it up a little bit. My grandfather is an Armenian. He's living in Constantinople. The genocide of 1915 breaks out. 1.5 million Armenians are massacred. He survives by hiding in an attic in Istanbul. He takes up there some books, French poet Verlaine, Maupassant, and he hides up there. And when he comes down, he has he becomes a young poet, and he gets a chance. A rich, wealthy Armenian survivor of the genocide falls in love with his poetry and asks him if he'd like to go to the Sorbonne in Paris.
Yeah.
And so yes, that's where he's headed. And then these letters come, each one more blood red than the one before, from his uncle, the only surviving patriarch in the family, who's moved to Fresno, California. And he's telling them he has to come here. And there's my grandfather, in his later years, before senility set in, he told me about these letters and this choice he had between Paris and Fresno. And here's a snippet from one of those letters that his uncle is writing. Here, find an Eden of pomegranate and peach, grapes that hang like jade eggs, watermelons so capacious that when you finish eating their delicious meat, you can float inside their shells in the cool waters of irrigation canals. Armenians by the thousands have come. We are farming raisins. We have started 2 newspapers, a theater group, a literary group, and 2 coffee houses. You must see it with your own 2 eyes to believe it. And so my grandfather, Paris or Fresno, he takes the bait, comes out here in 1920. And the next thing you know, he's a fruit tramp, traveling up and down the valley, picking the fruits and vegetables.
Wow. So this use of the word Eden from your grandfather's uncle, that is what Californians were trying to create, this garden of almost unbelievable delights, as he writes here. And that persists. I mean, the desire to do that persists, I think, still even to this day. But one of the lessons of your book is that dream is just running flat up against reality.
It's a really powerful myth. And you know, as his train's coming in, he's saying, wow, this is just like the old land. But it wasn't. It was this supercharged experiment that really had not slowed down since the gold rush. I mean, that was that beginning, that hurtling forward, is something that became our ethos. And it's still there. And now it's bumping up against these constraints, the constraints of too many people, the overdevelopment of farmland, the overdevelopment of cities, and you know, what's going to happen. But the myth is, ever so powerful.
Yeah. So one of the great joys of live radio is you never know where the conversation's going to go. But one of the pains is that I'm trying to balance a lot of different things. And you have so many great stories in your book, Mark, that I wish we could get to. But I want to honor our callers as well who have some questions for you. So let's go back to the phones. Craig is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Craig, you're on the air. What's your question for Mark Erics?
Hi. Yeah, I got a two-part question, actually. Why doesn't California have a desalinization plant?
And your other question, Craig?
Well, I mean, from the salt that they get, because I know, like, up there in Nebraska, they use a lot of salt. I know Midwestern states do, for the roads. So it'd be a win-win, I'm thinking.
Mm. Okay. Well, Craig, thank you for your call. Mark, is desal part of, or does it need to be part of California's future?
It's been talked about. We built one near Santa Barbara. It closed up. They're expensive. They have some environmental, effects.
They take a lot of energy.
they sure do. Yeah. I think the Californians who want to be saved from these constraints, they will. You know, that becomes one of the ideas. And it may be that in the future, if we continue to, insist on growing and everything else, that we will have to, to take that desal plant out of mothballs and build some others, and it might be part of a larger solution.
Yeah. Well, there is a really key figure in your book that I do want to spend some time hearing about, Mark, and that is Stuart Resnick. He's the richest farmer in America. Tell us about Stuart Resnick and why he plays such an important role in the story of California's water.
Yeah, I mean, this book could have been subtitled "Chasing Water and Dust and Stuart Resnick Across California." I've been trying to nail down his story for more than a decade. And Stuart Resnick is a classic Californian. He came from somewhere else. He came from New Jersey, and he came out here in the 1950s to reinvent himself. His dad was a bar owner, and today, like the old barons of wheat, like Isaac Friedlander. Stuart Resnick isn't of this place. I mean, he's never driven a tractor or cranked open an irrigation valve, never put his foot on the shoulder of a shovel or dug down into the soil. I mean, he really wouldn't know one of his Valencia orange groves from one of his Washington navel orange groves. He lives in Beverly Hills, and he farms in the valley. And the center of his empire is Lost Hills. And Lost Hills and Beverly Hills could not be two different places on the California map. And he, the land to him is kind of not real. It's like an economy of scale that no one's tried. And he is the biggest farmer in the United States. And the remaking of Stuart Resnick really began with going to UCLA Law School, and then he became a cleaner of LA buildings, a vendor of security alarms. He owned the Franklin Mint. He owns Fiji Water. And then he owns all this farmland in California and some in Mexico and Texas too. And he's 81 now, and he's gotten so big, he really doesn't know how big.
Wow.
But he's the single biggest grower of almonds, pistachios, pomegranates, and citrus in the world.
Wow.
And he uses more water than any other person in the West.
Wow. In your book, though, you also write about how, thinking about broadly how water is, you said it's a public good, but there are places where it is being privatized. But that Stuart Resnick, at one point in time, he sold water back to the state of California for a profit? How did he do
right,
that?
So Resnick actually farms, a lot of his farming is in a place called Western Kern County. And Western Kern County, unlike much of the valley, doesn't have groundwater. The groundwater is so polluted, it's no good. And it's so deep that not even the pumps can reach it. So what he had to do to make this empire bigger was he had to acquire from the state of California a water bank. A water bank is essentially a place that in flood times they park the water into the earth. And so the ground is porous enough to accept this water, but there's a membrane around that earth deep down so it doesn't migrate out. So it becomes this lake that you can borrow from. And so in flood years, he had so much water in that underground lake that replaced groundwater for him, that he was able to pull it out. And mind you, this is water that comes down the state water project.
Mm-hmm.
And because he's a contractor on the state water project. So he takes that water, pumps it out from the bank, and then sells it back to the state of California. So they were giving him the water at, let's say, $28 an acre foot. He was selling it back to them for $200 an acre foot, so they could give more to the fish where the water originally came from.
Oh, wow.
So it was almost like this laundering of water, if such a thing could happen. But and it's just not Stuart Resnick. it's his wife, Linda. She's the great marketer. She calls herself the Pomegranate Princess. And you've seen their ads. You know, if you're watching the Super Bowl, you'll see their ads for wonderful pistachios, wonderful almonds, palm wonderful, the great antioxidant, you know, drink. They're very controversial figures because they're farming the land from such a distance.
Well, Mark, you still...
And yet they're...
Oh, Mark, it looks like you're...
in their communities. Yeah.
Your line's still there. It sounds like it's dropping out a little bit, but hopefully it'll hold on for another 4 minutes because that's all the time we have left here. So therefore, I want to just get at least one more caller here. Eric is calling from Castleton, Vermont. Eric, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted you to talk about Chinatown, the movie with Jack Nicholson, if you could, if you research that at all, as it does bring up a little bit of the water wars between Northern California, Southern California, the orange groves, and all that fun stuff.
Yeah.
I grew up in the Santa Clara Valley back in the 60s, so we got a little bit of knowledge about the water situation out there in California.
Well, Eric, ask and ye shall receive. Here is a scene from Chinatown.
Going to be a lot of irate citizens when they find out that they're paying for water that they're not going to get.
Oh, that's all taken care of. See, Mr. Gibbs, either you bring the water to L.A., or you bring L.A. to the water.
How are you going to do that?
By incorporating the valley into the city. Simple as that.
John Huston and Jack Nicholson in 1974 in Chinatown. Eric, thank you for your call. Mark, you had some thoughts. Do you have any thoughts about Chinatown?
It's still a powerful metaphor that, you know, it's one of our metaphors. And the idea is that do you want water? Should the city be taking water from somewhere else, which is what we've done here? I have a whole chapter on that. I mean, it was written beautifully by Mark Reisner in Cadillac Desert. And I did some new research, borrowed from Reisner. And so that you cannot write a book about water and the California dream without touching upon Chinatown.
Well, you know, Mark, we only have about 2 minutes left here. And I wanted to just end by hearing from you about if there are some solutions here, because we talk about the California dream. Your book is called The Dreamt Land. Indicating that perhaps the dream has come to an end. You've even used the word delirium. So, I mean, is there a way to cope with what the reality of California and water is? What are the solutions?
Well, after 165 years, we have now finally we're regulating groundwater, and that's because the land is sinking from all the pumping. And I think this takes effect, and it's a long kind of lead up to it, but it'll take effect in 15 years. You're going to see the footprint of agriculture in the San Joaquin Valley alone probably 5 to 4.5, maybe all the way down to 4 million acres. So the farm belt will get smaller and smarter because we went from farming very good land to farming marginal land to now farming poor land. Mm. Just because we kept having water that we were taking and it had to go onto land. So that's going to diminish. But the city's going to have to do their part. I mean, can we keep sprawling out, growing suburbia ever more, you know, all the way up to places like Paradise where a town should have never gone? And this is what's going to have to happen if we're going to figure out a way to you know, continue this myth and this experiment that's California into the next 50 years.
Well, Mark Erics is author of The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. We have an excerpt of the book at onpointradio.org. Mark, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much for joining us today.
Yeah, I love the way you framed the whole segment. Thank you for having me.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Allison Poli, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, and Grace Tatter, with help from David Marino. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Agnes Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.